conversion experiences. I looked around at school, and I noticed that most kids not raised like me had something different in their lives. There was far less structure, and far fewer eyes on them. They were growing up with at least some opportunity to screw up their lives, to sin, at least a bit. This was before regular folks started slotting their kids into a demanding regimen of ceaseless lessons and sports. Kids ran freer then, so they had opportunity to sin, and not just by omissions, by commissions, by going too far and doing too much. They didn't live with the strict levels of control that we church kids did. Their parents were, in most cases, far less vigilant and prohibitive of all things fun. They were left unattended for longer periods of time, for far too long in some cases, at the one end of tyranny, and at the other, neglect of children and absentee parents. Some kids had a key on a shoelace around their neck, which they used to puncture the tops of juice boxes and puddings, and would let themselves into the house after school, watch whatever TV they wanted, waiting until a parent came home. Some of us, by contrast, had a parent drive us to and from school, and also work in our school all day, and our parents were often our Sunday school teachers, too. Our days were terribly, consistently decent. We seemed to be at meeting most of the time. And everyone was freshly showered and nicely dressed there. No one ever smelled of cigarettes or alcohol. No one ever swore. You'd never see a girl's cleavage or anyone's knee there. Growing up, I was pretty much never away from a parent for 3 minutes at a time. My parents spanked me rather often with a wooden paddle with Bible verses written on it, but I certainly didn't go through what Darlene did. Darlene says,
"We had no TV, radio, or newspaper. I wasn't allowed to play with neighbors. Had to go right home from school. No talking at meals. My dad had Bible study every morning before school. Often I missed the bus. Had to walk in freezing weather with a skirt on. I was frozen when I got to school. We were not allowed any outside access by television, radio, or newspapers. Schoolwork suffered from lack of knowledge when assignments were due. I was unable to relate often to what teachers or classmates were talking about, as I never heard any news. My father used the stick and belt on us nearly every day. When I was 17, I ran away. They tried to get me home, but I refused."
It must be said that Darlene's experience of a local TW Brethren upbringing is neither typical, nor is it unique. I know a lot of Christians who grew up to be absolutely unequivocally in love with secrets, as concepts and as things they can have themselves. It was TW Brethren Girls who first introduced me to PostSecret.com. I wonder if this is a response to how very watched we always were, by everyone, even as young adults. One thing is certain. Growing up and going to school, we were a bit odd. Our concept of sin was pretty different from most people's, and our view of ourselves as chronic sinners. We just knew we'd lie and steal and stuff like that if we got the chance. We were pure evil. We knew it. It was the only interesting thing about us, too, we felt. But often, the reality was that we hadn't done much of anything, didn't intend to do much of anything, hadn't so much as lied about standing watching V, the Final Battle, on the silent TVs in the display windows of the stores. Oh, we'd gone ahead and watched those televisions all right, though. Such a clear hunger for the things of this world. But we admitted it. In retrospect, I think part of this "man would we sin" focus came from and was fed by our hymns, prayers, and sermons and how they presented conversion experiences. In part, it stemmed from the fact that all of the very best hymns, all the way from Amazing Grace right on down to Zion Mourns in Fear and Anguish, painted a very dramatic and simple dichotomy of the process. Lost, then saved. Sinners, then saints. Partiers, then brethren people. And I think that we were feeling left out of this equation, many of us, if we were raised in the church. The favorite topic for hymns and sermons was about what satisfied customers we were, now that we had found Jesus, about how very bad everything and we ourselves had been before we found him. This was, in other churches, called one's testimony. We didn't call it that, and in most cases, we didn't have those, because there'd been no dramatic change, no story at all, really. I was born in this culture, I'm still in it. but we sang the hymns anyway. Human beings make sense of life by crafting it all into stories. It's no different with conversion experiences. The I once was a poor, filthy, raging, out-of-control, drunk, horrible sinner, dabbling in the occult and having sex with strangers and swearing, but now I am utterly changed by Christ's finished work into a decent, humble, middle-class, business-casual Christian testimony story is one that really works. This is why it was a central message of so many Victorian and pre-Victorian hymns. And it was a big part of the revival movement, too, after that. That's where we got our hymns from, the revival movement and the Victorian age. Not from Keith Green and the Jesus People movement that were part of the hippy-dippy 1960s and 70s. Those guys certainly wrote enough Christian songs, of course. We never heard any of them, though, growing up. Not reverent. Too jazzy. Wrong century. What most of us church folk had for a testimony didn't really fit the I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. Pattern of our hymns at all. It was much more, I once was too young to understand what my parents were telling me about salvation, but once I was three, I became a Christian before I'd really been anything else, and I still am. It's nice, I guess. Wouldn't make a very memorable hymn for us to sing. I knew that. But I was taught it was terribly important that I not sin now, because if I did, man, would I sin, I imagined. That was why we went to church, and had always done that. We didn't call them church services, we called them our meetings. And they were meetings, for Sinners Anonymous, protection against ourselves and our tragic, though admittedly untapped, potential for sin. It was our anti-sin maintenance, salvation through church culture. It was our indoctrination. And all this was normal for us. This is what church meant, protection against our own natural depravity. Although one could argue for the total Lutheran tulip depravity of a two-year-old, I suppose, the story many of us had really didn't ring out as very dramatic, and we felt this. We'd been robbed. That story others could tell to rapt audiences, being lost, sinning, really sinning, finding their way to God as seeking teenagers or troubled adults, and finding that God or church structure transformed their lives, made it utterly different than it had been before, we just didn't really have any of that. Those guys were so lucky to have met a God who actually forgave them things they'd actually done. We mostly only understood God's forgiveness as an abstract concept, as theology, as doctrine, something we had to take on faith. We could sing Amazing Grace, but it didn't quite apply. Not as deeply anyway. Not for us. It always felt weird to sing endlessly about having been rebellious, sinning creatures of darkness when we'd been coming out to church almost every evening of the week since before we could remember, and we'd never so much as played a game of cards, seen Disney's The Black Hole, or said a swear word, because we didn't allow ourselves any of that. Our view of the Christian person was of someone who heroically made his way through an evil world, walking a narrow path, saying no to all of its temptations and pleasures, like the character Christian in the very Puritan John Bunyan's A Pilgrim's Progress. There was nothing in the world for us at all but illusions like mirages in the desert. To stray from that narrow path and wander into the wasteland that was the world was to invite spiritual death. This excerpt from a lengthy hymn we sang by John Nelson Darby, the man who is often seen as the father of the Brethren movement, illustrates this quite clearly.
This world is a wilderness wide. We have nothing to seek or to choose. We've no thought in the ways to abide. We've not to regret nor to lose. The Lord is Himself gone before. He has marked out the path that we tread. It's as sure as the love we adore. We have nothing to fear nor to dread. There is but that one in the waist, which his footsteps have marked as his own. And we follow in diligent haste to the seats where he's put on his crown.
Bruce Hales, head of the strictest branch of Plymouth Brethren I have yet been able to discover, writes rather more emphatically,
"We have to get a hatred, an utter hatred of the world. Unless you've come to a hatred of the world, you're likely to be sucked in by it and seduced by it. You must hate the world, every feature of the world. At every point, you hate it."